From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Yesterday, President Obama repeated that he sees glimmers of hope in the economy. On today's Fresh Air, we asked Simon Johnson what he sees. He's the former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund and a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management. In this new phase of the bailout, he's expecting a showdown between big banks and the government over who is running the financial system. In his article, The Quiet Coup, published in the May edition of The Atlantic, he writes that in order to get out of our financial crisis, we have to break the power of the financial oligarchy that is blocking reform. Simon Johnson on the next phase of the economic crisis coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The bailout of the banking system is entering a new phase, and it's likely to include a showdown between the banks and the government, according to my guest, Simon Johnson. Johnson is the former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, the IMF. He's a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, the co-founder of the global economics website Baseline Scenario, and he recently started writing for the New York Times economics blog. In the May edition of The Atlantic, Johnson has an article titled The Quiet Coup, in which he says that in order to get out of our financial crisis, we have to break the power of the financial oligarchy that is blocking reform. Simon Johnson, welcome back to Fresh Air. The Obama administration said yesterday that it would reveal some of the results of the stress tests it's administered to the banks. So let's start with what the stress tests are designed to do and what function they serve.
Stress tests are totally sensible. It's like going to the doctor because you think you may be a problem with your heart, and they put you on a treadmill, and they put your heart under some stress carefully, and they look at the effects of that. Well, it's the same thing with banks. They go in and they look at what's really on the balance sheet, and they think about how the balance sheet would look if the economy is worse or substantially worse or dramatically worse than its current performance. And so in that sense, they're stressing. It's an imaginary thing, obviously, but they're stressing how the banks will do if we have a really severe recession.
And what's the final purpose of doing this?
Well, it's to see if the financial system is going to have a heart attack or is in danger of having a heart attack or should get some different medicine in order to reduce the risk of the kind of financial meltdown that we saw back in September, October of last year. So it's an attempt to assess who's in good shape and who's in bad shape, who needs to work out more, including work out some of their toxic debt issues.
And is it a survival of the fittest thing that the banks that fail a stress test basically either get bailed out or are allowed to die?
Well, you could use a stress test to do that. You could use it to support, to sort of divide the banks into the ones that are going to go forward and the ones that are going to be taken over or wound down. I don't think the government's going to do that. They've sent very strong signals that they said it's not pass-fail. And they said that now they're saying the latest indications are all banks will pass to some degree. I think there's going to be some B-minuses and some A-pluses, but everybody gets to pass. And they may get different instructions, if you like, health warnings or things to do from the doctor as we move forward.
Why do you think the Obama administration originally planned to keep the results of the stress test secret and now plan on revealing some of the information from the stress tests?
Well, anytime you reveal this kind of very sensitive information, you run the risk of destabilizing markets. For example, if they tell you that certain banks have a B-minus or even a D-minus, and they assure you it's still a passing grade, I think the markets might take a negative view on that bank. And so they wanted to manage the flow of this information very carefully. But it does seem that particularly over the last week or so, that the big banks have forced the government's hand by actually revealing some of the information themselves or, you know, in the case of Goldman Sachs, basically stating how they're going to do in the stress test. And you know, this means that if you don't reveal information about other banks, they're going to be at a competitive disadvantage. People are going to assume the worst about banks that don't speak out on this issue. So the government, I think, feels a need to try and even the playing field here.
So you think that the government is responding to Goldman Sachs, basically saying, we're doing good?
Well, it's not just Goldman. It's Wells Fargo has been quite aggressive in its language, and Citigroup and Bank of America have also made positive statements. Statements that it seems the government didn't actually want them to make because it would exactly tilt the playing field to their advantage.
Now Goldman Sachs wants to give back the $10 billion in TARP money that it got, and it's sold $5 billion in new stock, which it intends to put toward returning the TARP. Why is Goldman anxious to return the TARP money?
Well, Goldman's motivation, which they're quite clear about, is that they would like to go back to having the same kind of compensation scheme that they had before with very big bonuses in particular. That's not currently allowed or there's a lot of restrictions on that under the TARP program. If they think, they're arguing, that if they pay back this capital, if they're allowed to pay it back, then they will be able to run very high bonus schemes again, attract talent, and basically take a lot of market share away from their competitors. So it's an attempt to really make a very big competitive move on their part.
Why might the Obama administration be concerned about this and be less than enthusiastic about letting Goldman give back the TARP money? I mean, it sounds like a good thing. The government's getting $10 billion in TARP money back if this happens. Like, why wouldn't they want it?
Well, we do want our TARP money back. There's no question about that. And of course, there have been worries about that money being lost. And so this is quite reassuring on that front. But at the same time, it's not clear that you want Goldman Sachs to get a big jump on the competition, that this could be potentially destabilizing. Banks that are not in a position to pay back their TARP money could actually find their business models further undermined, their ability to raise further capital. And of course, we could end up paying more out of the total TARP program if other banks come under pressure. It also seems, you know, the government's making the very reasonable point, and this is actually being articulated nicely in a New York Times article this morning, that these banks exist or are using substantial other forms of government assistance right now, including in some cases credit from the Federal Reserve, but also they're stressing the program that the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC, put in place, where they are basically guaranteeing some of these banks' debt. And that was something that was done in the fall under emergency circumstances. It's still there. And in addition, of course, the government still owns some warrants or options to buy the stock in these large banks. And again, you know, if you withdraw that support, what happens to the big banks and what happens to their competitors? That's a hot topic.
So in other words, what Goldman would be doing is still getting some government backup, even though it was giving back the TARP money, and that it would no longer have any strings attached.
Exactly. You know, there's a very old saying that Wall Street owns the upside and the taxpayer owns the downside. This seems like a pretty blatant demonstration that holds today more than ever.
But what Goldman is saying is that the FDIC program doesn't come with strings attached. Goldman, when it accepted participation in that, didn't know that there would ever be strings attached. So why should it be punished for staying in that program?
It's a fascinating showdown between the big banks, led by Goldman in this instance, and the government. Basically, the government is trying to act in the interest of the system. The government saved the day back in the fall at tremendous cost to the taxpayer, but it had to be done. And they want the banks to sort of cooperate with them in getting the financial system as a whole back on its feet. The big banks don't really want to do this in the way that the Federal Reserve and the FDIC and the Treasury are asking. So it's a confrontation. It's a demonstration or a showdown. The two sides are, I think, going to bare their teeth and make various kinds of statements. We'll see who will prevail here. I'm personally on the side of the government.
I know you won't have the answer to this, but I can't help but wonder what's going through the minds of the people behind the TARP, who are now seeing, like, you know, they took this risk, they gave all this money to the banks, and now they might be seeing the banks as trying to undermine the program by paying the money back and getting out of the restrictions and adding new uncertainties into the system.
I don't know what they're thinking, but my guess and my reading of the stories that are coming out and the way that various newspapers have been briefed on this is that the government officials, particularly the Fed, Federal Reserve, and the Treasury, are very frustrated at this point. They went to extraordinary lengths. They worked very hard to save the banks. They've bent over backwards to really accommodate the banks and to help them out as much as possible. I personally think they've gone a bit too far. I think they could have been tougher on the banks, you know, a couple of months ago or even 4 months ago. But, you know, that's all water under the bridge. Right now, I think they're going to be very frustrated that these banks are not playing ball. And you know, who's in charge here? Who's calling the shots? Who's making the big strategic decisions about the U.S. financial system and its future? Is it the people running the Treasury and the Fed, or is it Goldman Sachs? I think maybe we'll find out a little bit more about that this week and next.
Some people are concerned that Goldman Sachs has special connections to the government. There's even like conspiracy theories floating around about this. For example, Robert Rubin, who was Treasury Secretary under President Clinton, was ahead of Goldman. Hank Paulson, who was Treasury Secretary under President Bush, was with Goldman. Timothy Geithner's chief of staff was formerly with Goldman. The new head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, formerly with Goldman. The new CEO of AIG had been on the board of Goldman. So what do you make of that? And do you think that this gives Goldman Sachs a special advantage on the playing field?
I don't. I'm not a fan of conspiracy theories in general. I don't think there's a conspiracy in the financial sector. I think there is a system of belief in Washington. It's perhaps more dangerous than a conspiracy. A system of belief that what's good for Wall Street is good for Washington, good for the country. And in that system of belief, Goldman Sachs, without doubt, plays a particular role as a thought leader, as an innovator in all kinds of interactions with government. And they have had some particular individuals who played important roles, as you identified, Mr. Rubin and Mr. Paulson, stand out. But I wouldn't, you know, go overboard stressing it's just about Goldman Sachs or just about those individuals. It's much broader, deeper, and problematic beliefs that somehow we should always accommodate these banks, bend over backwards, do what we can to help them back on their feet. And whenever they get into trouble, we, the taxpayer, are going to take the risks, bear the costs of that. I don't think that's a good system going forward. And if we've really built banks, we have banks, obviously, clearly, that are too big to fail, shouldn't we start asking whether they're also too big to exist?
You think that's what we should be asking?
That's what I'm asking. And I think, and I'm surprised and kind of pleased that by how many people, very technocratic, centrist people, people who used to work in the U.S. Treasury, people who used to work for the IMF, or people who still work for the IMF, people who are economic historians, spent their life studying the structure of the U.S., people who are not very political and certainly not of the left or of the right, people are saying to me, yes, you know, I think you have a point. This too big to fail has a lot of implications in terms of the structure of the financial industry going forward. And assuming that we can come up with a better tweaking of the regulatory system seems kind of illusory because it's never happened in the past. So either we come up with a better, more magical regulator than has ever existed in the history of humankind, or we have to go about this differently in a somewhat cruder fashion. And one, not a panacea, but one piece of that approach could well be smaller banks or making it harder for banks to become so big that they threaten the financial system.
My guest is Simon Johnson, former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund and a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the next phase of the financial bailout with Simon Johnson, former chief economist of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. He's a professor at MIT and co-founded the global economy website Baseline Scenario. When we left off, we were talking about Goldman Sachs, which wants to pay back the TARP money it got from the government bailout. But the situation is more complicated than it may seem. So even if Goldman Sachs gives back $10 billion in TARP money to the government and says, now we're free of the TARP, so we don't want restrictions anymore. It's still got, I think, around $13 billion through the AIG bailout because it was a counterparty to AIG. So, in other words, AIG owed Goldman money, and it paid that money through its bailout. So Goldman Sachs has been able to get to this point through several phases of the bailout, and it's certainly not going to be giving back the AIG money that it got through the bailout.
That's right. they won't. Look, it, Goldman Sachs and the rest of the financial system, certainly the big banks, received a huge amount of support, both through the government stepping in to save AIG or to protect its obligations in the derivatives markets. Those are credit default swaps for which Goldman was the counterparty back in September. But there was also a lot of other forms of assistance provided. Goldman Sachs was allowed to change its legal form so they could have access to the Federal Reserve and get a large amount of credit when the system was under duress. I mean, we're talking about trillions of dollars that were provided by the taxpayer to save the financial system. And I think that was fine. It was needed. The banks, you know, probably would have, many of them would have failed without that support. So, you know, now the question is, why don't the banks want to play ball? Not with me, not with my suggestions for reform. I'm sure they would consider those far too radical. Why don't they want to cooperate with the Treasury and with the Fed, people who've really saved their bacon? It's quite strange and I think a little bit close to being incomprehensible, the attitude and the hubris of the banks under these circumstances.
So Goldman is saying it wants to give back the TARP money, largely because it wants to be free of the restrictions, and those restrictions include limits on executive compensation. And of course, the argument is that if they're free of limits on executive compensation, they can offer more to the people they want to hire. They can keep people, and they can hire people, and thereby have a competitive advantage by getting the best people. But a lot of people are skeptical about this because, I mean, the, quote, best people with the biggest compensation packages are the people who kind of made these decisions that helped get us into this mess in the first place.
Yes, it's a very good point. And of course, what they'd like, the limits they'd like to remove are not just on executive compensation for the very top people, but also on the compensation schemes and the bonus schemes for people throughout the organization. And of course, I think there's a lot of agreement on the following point, that the nature of compensation in these big banks, the way in which people were encouraged and rewarded for taking risk, really brought the system to the brink of absolute failure and meltdown, because people take risks today, get cash bonuses today, by putting together deals and transactions that would lead to problems down the road. Sometimes people call it picking up nickels in front of a bulldozer, the idea being that most of the time you get the nickels, sometimes you get run over by the bulldozer. And of course, if it's the next guy to have your job who actually gets run over, you know, so much the better, would go that attitude. So there is a real question about whether they should be allowed to rebuild essentially the same system as before. No doubt they will say they've tweaked it. They will say they've addressed some of these issues. But nobody has yet been convinced, nobody from the outside has yet been convinced that they've really done that.
Do you think that the American public will be angry if things go back to those really oversized compensation packages that existed before the bailout?
I think the American people mostly care about the jobs and being able to afford their mortgages. And if the economy turns around and there's a recovery, they probably will be willing to let the banks go about their business again. The danger there, of course, is if you have the same system and the same vulnerabilities, then some point in the future, I don't know if it's in 2 years or 5 years or 10 years, you could have another financial catastrophe of this nature. Remember, this crisis is probably going to push up our national debt from around 40% of GDP. That's where we're starting. That's at a sort of reasonably moderate level of debt. I think by the time we're done with this, you include fiscal stimulus, bailout packages, the whole works, we'll probably be closer to 80, maybe 90% of GDP. Debt to GDP ratio. That's quite a lot. And that's not all, right? If we rebuild or allow to continue the same financial structure as before, we are looking for trouble, and we should expect to have another big financial meltdown at some point. And that one we may not be able to afford.
So what choices does the Obama administration have to make now regarding Goldman and whether it lets Goldman pay back the TARP and free itself of restrictions, government restrictions on compensation and other practices?
Well, I think that's exactly the decision that they have to make. It is for the government to decide, not for Goldman Sachs to decide. It's for the government to decide if Goldman Sachs is sufficiently strong to be allowed to pay back the TARP money and discharge its other obligations, or claim the other obligations don't come with restrictions on executive compensation on bonuses. I would strongly suggest that the government can draw a line here and say, no, we're not ready for this. You're not ready for this. The system is not ready for this. We have a responsibility to the system. I think it's a showdown. I think if the government can face down Goldman Sachs on this key issue, which Goldman Sachs cares a lot, and they've raised the stakes by making these very public statements about what they're going to do, if the government, if the Treasury, if the Fed, and if the White House can face down Goldman on this one, then I'm going to feel much more optimistic about the future.
Because
this is about power. And this is about telling the financial sector that they do not run this country. The country is run by people who have been elected to run the country. And having the financial sector build up massive vulnerabilities, create enormous dangers, generate big, big costs for the taxpayer, and then walk away as if nothing had happened and go back to getting the upside while we, you know, going to hold any future downside risk, that, to my mind, is not acceptable.
Are there risks to the Obama administration if it says no to Goldman, if it says we're not ready to let you give back the TARP money and be free of the government restrictions yet?
I am sure that the financial sector will make two points to them, are making two points to them. First of all, that, you know, you need healthy banks in order to have a recovery. Everybody's been saying that. And if you let us go back to our previous incentive schemes, we'll be healthier. We'll be able to attract better people. You will get more of a recovery. And by the way, if you don't do this, if you take actions that undermine us and at all destabilize us, this could jeopardize the financial system and cause further panic and collapse. So there is an element of you can call it blackmail in this situation. And that's why it's a showdown. It's not because Goldman Sachs is threatening to take over the government. It's because Goldman Sachs is saying, well, you know, it's up to you guys. If you don't do as we say, then you're not going to have a recovery. You're going to have lots of unemployment. And we'll make sure everybody knows it's all your fault.
Could Goldman sabotage the recovery?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's a system. It's a very big system, and it's subject to all kinds of forces domestically and globally. But there's no question that they can position themselves and they can convey certain messages, and people who work with them and are favorable to them can convey messages that would make the administration look less good or make it look more good. So they have tremendous influence. They have a lot of say on Capitol Hill. I think that the game is played in at a subtle and deep level with all kinds of interesting, you know, communications strategies and lots of sort of movement with events. Lots of things happen that you don't expect. But these big financial players are very serious. They're very sophisticated, and they see this as their economy, and they want it back.
Simon Johnson will be back in the second half of the show. He's a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and co-founder of the global economics website Baseline Scenario. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance, sponsor of the Progressive Automotive X Prize, a race to develop cars that exceed 100 miles per gallon. Now, that's progressive. From LendingTree, where you can choose from up to four customized loan offers. 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win. LendingTree.com. And from Netflix and Universal Studios Home Entertainment, presenting the unrated comedy Role Models on Blu-ray and DVD at Netflix.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Simon Johnson about the quiet coup, his article in The Atlantic magazine, in which he says the financial industry has effectively captured our government and we need to break its grip in order for the economy to recover. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about the economic crisis and the next stage of the bailout with Simon Johnson, former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, the IMF. He's also a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management and a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He has an article in The Atlantic titled The Quiet Coup about what he describes as the financial oligarchy that is blocking economic reform in the U.S. In the Atlantic article that you have in the current edition, the May edition of the Atlantic, you make several comparisons between our economic crisis and the crises you saw at the International Monetary Fund when you were working with emerging markets. And you say, you know, you work with a lot of countries ruled by oligarchies. And let's just define our term oligarchy here, and then I'll ask you the question. So when you say oligarchy, what do you mean?
I mean a pretty small group of people who have a lot of economic power and tremendous political influence in any country.
So you say in emerging markets, when a country is in economic crisis, it's usually because the powerful elites, the oligarchies within them, overreached in good times and took too many risks. Do you see a parallel here in our country?
Yes, I do. I think it's a pretty standard pattern around the world when you have major booms. That people who start out with, you know, some resources, some access, some, you know, sort of profile politically and opportunities economically, they make big investments, they make a lot of money, and they plow it back in, both into the economic side of things, but also into the political side of things, and they build up more influence. And of course, a lot of investors, people supporting various kinds of oligarchs, like that. And foreign investors are delighted when you have more access to the president, for example, and that lets you get your hands on more capital, make more investments, and the whole boom or bubble goes on for quite a while until, of course, it explodes.
You think that part of the problem we have in the United States is that the finance sector became more powerful under Presidents Reagan, Clinton, and Bush. In what way did that sector become more powerful?
Well, I think the financial sector has always been important in this country. It's always been involved in economic policymaking. But if you look at the data, the government data from 1980, you see a dramatic increase in how much of corporate profits are earned in the financial sector. And of course, you see a very big increase in the average compensation in that sector relative to the rest of the country. So I think that it was a boom that made sense. There was some deregulation initially that, you know, probably was also sensible. But as the firms made this money, and as the individuals involved made this money, they plowed it back into political access. And of course, they were able to shape a lot of the regulatory environment, particularly around derivatives, which was a new technology that came along late 80s and particularly in the 1990s. They were able to really convince government and the rest of us that they should be allowed a free hand in building these markets. And that obviously has not gone very well for us, at least.
If one is concerned, as you are, that people on Wall Street have too much power when it comes to determining what kind of regulations Wall Street will have, and if they have like too much power politically in terms of lobbying, what do you think could be done to change that? If you consider that there's something of a financial oligarchy in the United States, what do you think could change that?
Well, my concern is not about Wall Street as a whole. I mean, I think that the financial sector is going to become smaller because it overexpanded in the very long boom, and there's now some natural contraction. My concern is about the power of a relatively few massive players on Wall Street. And of course, after the crisis, with Bear Stearns going out of business and Lehman also having disappeared and some other reshaping, the big financial players who remain are even larger relative to key markets and more influential, I think, on central decisions, for example, around the bailout. So I'm talking about Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan and Citigroup, Bank of America, arguably, as well, and some other players. So I think that there's a case for finding ways to constrain the size of these banks. They have peaked, some of them peaked with the size or total balance sheet around 20% of the U.S. economy. And, you know, it's clear from the discussions about too big to fail that this, you know, creates lots of problems and lots of potential obligations for the taxpayer going forward. So I think we should find ways to make the biggest banks smaller. And there's various ideas out there. For example, a tax on bigness, having to pay more tax or having to put up more capital when you become large relative to the system. I think we want to get away from a situation where the failure of one, two, or five players can really jeopardize the entire U.S. and global economy.
Is that a new way of looking at too big to fail? I mean, I've heard several people lately talking about how there needs to be a special way of treating these institutions that could put our whole economy in jeopardy because they're too big to fail. Have ideas about treating those institutions differently surfaced before, or is this only since the crisis that people have been talking about that?
I think the discussion of this issue has become more intense since the crisis. Ideas like this have been around for a long time. And obviously, there's a tradition in the United States of being very suspicious of big industrial or financial power. And if you go back to the 19th century and you look, for example, at the work of Steve Haber, who's an economic historian at Stanford, he documents very carefully and in a fascinating manner how the U.S. struggled, the U.S. political forces. You can call them populism if you want, but there was lots of mainstream people as well, mainstream business people, who didn't want there to be massive finance, and they struggled against this. And the 19th century, you can argue, was won by these rather more diffuse democratic forces, which we remember that in terms of the antitrust movement, and remember the breaking up of John D. Rockefeller's massive oil company, Standard Oil. What we don't remember quite as clearly is the way in which financial power was constrained, but it was. And I think we should go back to that 19th century philosophy, basically on which this country was built.
My guest is Simon Johnson, former chief economist of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Simon Johnson, and he's the former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. He teaches at MIT. He's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute. He's the co-founder of a website about the global economy called Baseline Scenario, and he recently became a writer for the New York Times economics blog. One of the new phases of the bailout is the plan for the government to help investors purchase toxic assets so that these toxic assets, which are so hard to value and are such a problem, can be taken off the bank's books. This is called the PPIP, the Public-Private Investment Program. So just give us a short summary of how this plan is supposed to work, and then we'll talk about it.
Sure. The basic idea is pretty simple. It's that banks have assets that are worth, let's say, 85 cents. And let's say they have an asset that, in principle, when it was issued, was worth a dollar. They've marked it down to about 85 cents, and that's their view of what it's worth. And there are people out there in the market, let's call them hedge funds, it's a much broader group, there are people out there in the market who think these things are really worth 40 cents. So there's a gap between the 40-cent view and the 85-cent view. The PPIP is supposed to bridge that gap by throwing in a subsidy from you and me, the taxpayer, via the Treasury, to try and close that gap. And you know, perhaps you could provide the subsidy in such a fashion that the bank would be willing to sell and the hedge fund would be willing to buy at 60 cents. So you're trying to close the gap that exists in the market between these two price views.
And what are the reasons why the banks may or may not be willing to bridge that gap and sell the assets?
Well, there's obviously some real tensions in the Geithner Treasury approach here. One is how hard the banks are being pushed. If you're giving the banks a lot of space and a lot of forbearance, you're saying, guys, just relax, the economy will recover and that'll take care of it. They don't really have a big incentive to sell for anything less than what they've already marked these assets at. So for them, their view may well be, look, 85 cents is the price, take it or leave it. We don't need to sell these things because we're not under a lot of pressure from our supervisor and from the Treasury, from the angle of looking at their solvency and seeing how much capital they have.
But what are the problems of holding on to these assets if nobody really wants to buy them at the price that the banks have priced them?
Well, the issue is, I think, that they hang over the bank's futures. They're sort of the sort of Damocles that dangles over you and makes you very worried about how you're going to be judged in the future. And generally speaking, in any kind of massive banking crisis like this one, it's better to clean up the balance sheets, which means remove the toxic assets. They're not really toxic, by the way. They're just bad. Toxic makes them sound a little too sophisticated and scary. They're just bad assets. They've gone bad. They were bad decisions made by these banks. And it's generally speaking better to get those out of the picture and let the banks concentrate on new business going forward.
And what are the risks and benefits for hedge funds in investing in these bad assets?
Well, it's quite a good deal, depending on obviously on the price that you end up paying. The government is providing so-called non-recourse loans, which means that if you put up $1 billion to play, you can leverage that tremendously, depending on exactly the transaction you're doing. You may be able to leverage that, you know, roughly or almost 10 times. And if it goes well, you keep a lot of the upside, you keep a lot of the profits, you have to share those to some degree with the Treasury. It's true. If it goes bad, then you lose your $1 billion that you put in as capital for this venture, but you don't lose anything else. There's no other claim on you because your venture defaulted on this big loan you got from the U.S. government. So it's a pretty good deal. It's a much better deal if you pay a lower price for these securities. And that's what I think the people who are doing their due diligence on this right now are thinking about.
Is there a precedent for this kind of program any place in the world that you're aware of?
Not really. Certainly not at anything like the scale that's currently being proposed. It is another great American financial innovation.
So, say this program is successful and investors purchase these bad assets. The bulk of them are taken off the bank's books. How does that change things?
Well, ideally, if these toxic or bad assets disappear. Oh, and by the way, we're not supposed to call them that anymore. We're supposed to call them legacy assets.
There's been a rebranding. That's right, rebranding, yes.
Anyway, if the legacy assets disappear, then depending on the price at which they disappear, the banks may be fully healthy again. And the prospect of further losses could vanish. So, you know, there is a way for us to magically remake our banks. It's a little hard, and it would involve a massive taxpayer subsidy. And apparently, we're not allowed to get a substantial amount of stock in return for that. So, you know, it's a great deal for the banks if it happens. It's not such a good deal for the taxpayer.
Well, you've used the term magically. Are you using that with cynicism that it would require magic for this to work?
Well, I believe in magic. The Easter Bunny does come once a year. With some help from parents, it's the magic of government subsidies. And yes, I am being a little bit cynical about it.
The Obama administration is considering offering the opportunity to individual investors to participate in this plan and buy these bad assets, probably through vehicles like mutual funds. And I'd be interested in hearing your analysis of that possibility.
I think it's a great idea. I mean, if it really is an investment with tremendous upside, which of course is how they're selling it to the hedge funds, then you should let individuals participate. Another good idea, by the way, that's got a lot of traction, that at least one origination was our website, was encouraging or allowing or telling bankers that they have to take their bonuses going forward in the form of these toxic assets. After all, they claim that these things are massively underpriced by the market and they're going to recover, so it should be a good deal for them on the bonus side too.
So who's proposed that?
We proposed that.
Oh, you proposed that.
somewhat humorously, but I believe it has got some traction in some of the big banks, and I'm not claiming that we were the absolute first originators of that. I don't think it's an idea you can patent, but it is a very appealing idea for symbolic as well as substantive reasons.
And the odds that banks would agree to that are
Not zero. I think there's one bank that's seriously considering it, or some reports say they're actually trying to implement it. I haven't heard the reaction from the executives to whom they made this proposal. But it is completely consistent with their belief system and the way that they've framed this issue to the government. They're saying that these markets are illiquid, that they're temporarily giving lower prices than these assets are actually worth. So it sounds perfect for a bonus scheme.
Now, I think it was on your website, Baseline Scenario, your website about the global economy, that I read that a lot of people are now using credit default swaps to basically bet against the banks. What does that mean?
So if you think in the old days, if you thought a bank was going to fail, you lined up outside the bank to take your money out. And a bank run was literally a run to the bank, as in run on your own two feet. Now, that doesn't happen very often. It's extremely rare because we have the FDIC, and that guarantees retail deposits. And those guarantees are, I would emphasize, absolutely sound. And they have plenty of support from the Treasury that there won't be a problem there. But if you think that banks are going to get into trouble, if you think that they're going to fail and have to restructure their debts, and there are some indications that the government may be edging in this direction, for example, with a new resolution authority that they're requesting from Congress, then you want to bet on the debt getting into trouble, on there being solvency issues. You don't do that by pulling out your deposits. That doesn't work. You could sell the stock, but the stock price can move around due to other forces. And so the credit default swap market is a relatively sophisticated or market that's really open to mostly to professional investors, and you can trade in that market in such a way that you're gambling on the risk of default going up. And when you place your bets, and if everyone else increasingly takes a view there's going to be more risk of default, you'll make money, and then you can get out of that market. You don't actually care in the end whether they default. You're betting on people's perceptions moving in a certain direction.
So if people are betting against the banks now with the credit default swaps, does that indicate anything? Does that indicate belief in the financial sector that some of these banks are going to fail?
Yes, it does. It indicates that people feel that the government is going to be forced to stop providing bailout money and to encourage or allow or even take charge of these banks converting debt into equity. So they will essentially default on the debt, and bondholders will get some share of the company instead. So it's like going through a bankruptcy process, going through Chapter 11, but that probably won't happen for these big banks because that would be very messy and very complicated. And so either with or without this new resolution authority that's being requested, the bank bondholders will take some losses. That is the view that's being expressed in this market, and it's a view that's increasingly putting pressure on some of the very largest banks.
So if that's seen as a kind of vote of no confidence in some of the large banks, does that have like an echoing response? Like if there's a vote of no confidence, does that increase the lack of confidence? Is that a spiraling effect?
Yes, it is spiraling. And so people sometimes call these self-fulfilling runs or self-fulfilling expectations. So the idea is, if you think about old-fashioned bank runs, you run to the bank and you stand in line. Other people see the line and they join the line because they say, oh, these people must know something. So we sort of join the panic. And the bank may run out of cash. The bank may actually be solvent but not have enough cash. So the run itself triggers more people running, and that triggers the failure of the bank. Or the bank runs out of liquidity. Now, that doesn't happen anymore. We've figured out the technology for protecting banks and providing them with enough liquidity and providing depositors with insurance. But what can happen in the credit default swap market is you see the credit default swap spread, as it's called, widening. That means the probability of default is going up. You think, ooh, something's going on here. The people must know something. You jump in and make your own bets on that probability going up further. And that increases, this credit default swap spread increases the cost of doing business, particularly in derivative transactions for these major banks. So it undermines the business model of these big banks that are under attack. And so the run can become self-fulfilling, very much like a run on a bank. Or we see it many times when countries have fixed exchange rates and people run out of that currency towards another, the run to what they regard as a safer currency, for example, from Russian rubles into U.S. dollars. Self-fulfilling speculative runs are unfortunately not behind us. Some of the big ones seem to lie in front of us now.
I guess one of the things that surprises me most about this story is that credit default swaps still exist. I mean, they've been so maligned. The word toxic has become so connected to credit default swaps. I'm surprised they still exist. I'm surprised people are still buying them. And will they be paid out, since there's been such problems with that in the past? That's part of the reason why we're in this economic crisis. I think I don't understand it well enough to articulate this any better than that, but I'm just so surprised that they're still, one of the like driving factors in our future, considering how they've already messed us up.
Well, the toxicity is a good question. The toxicity, of course, mostly comes from simpler things, from bad loans that were made on housing and from securities that were built out of those loans that really didn't make any sense. They were very vulnerable to an economic slowdown. The credit default swaps haven't failed or haven't shown themselves to be toxic in the same way. They have shown themselves to be very complex and very scary. And we do know that when AIG was taken over by the government, they went to some lengths to make sure there wasn't a default by AIG on its obligations. So there's a sense in which it's a bomb at the center of our financial system. And you're totally right; it hasn't been diffused. There are attempts now to make these transactions more transparent, to bring them onto exchanges, and there's a hope that this sort of technical step will diffuse the bomb. That remains to be seen, and it. You can also argue, I think we can argue all day, about how to balance the fact that these contracts, these kinds of swaps, are a legitimate way to insure yourself against risks that you face. At the same time, they're a speculative instrument, and the speculative instrument can actually potentially and obviously ironically end up ruining some of the big banks that helped create the credit default swap market. So I'm saying it's a little bit like Frankenstein's monster coming back to give Frankenstein a hard time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Simon Johnson. He's the former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund. He teaches at MIT, and he's the co-founder of the global economy website Baseline Scenario. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Simon Johnson, and he's the former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund. He teaches at MIT. He writes for the New York Times economics blog. He's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute, and he has a story in the current edition of The Atlantic, the May edition, about the bank bailout. You have kind of inspired a new movement as a result, in part, of an interview that you did with Bill Moyers, in which you compared the financial sector and the revolving door between government and the financial sector to an oligarchy. A new movement was inspired called A New Way Forward that had their first series of demonstrations on Saturday. And their goal is, quote, dismantling the power of the financial elites. So I guess I'm wondering what it's like for you to know that you, in part, inspired this movement.
It's very strange. It's not at all what I expected. I'm a very centrist, technocratic person, and I think I'm speaking on behalf of a lot of my friends, a lot of people I worked with at the IMF, a lot of people who worked on crises around the world. I'm kind of struck by the support that we're getting from people who are across the political spectrum. I think the New Way Forward, from what I've seen and what I've been able to glean, has picked up on some of our sensible, reasonable centrist ideas and is putting them out there in a more popular form. But I would emphasize there's people on the left and on the right who think that we've got some points here, particularly about the disproportionate power of the financial sector and the ways in which that could be quite carefully and over time and in a way that's not disruptive, that could be dismantled.
You know, there's many ways of seeing the financial crisis that we're in and what got us here. And one way is, and I think this is your way, that, you know, the oligarchy, that there's a group of like really powerful people who were in it for self-interest, who kind of played the system for personal and institutional gain, and they got us into a lot of trouble. Another way of seeing it is that people were involved with really complex financial instruments that nobody quite understood. There weren't bad intentions here. It's just that no one could have quite predicted how things would have played out, how we could have ended up in this perfect storm. And it wasn't just about, like, you know, greed and people playing the system. It's about a group of circumstances coming together in such a way that created a mess.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting way to frame the question. I don't have any problem with it. Basically, the second view is that it's not people became too powerful. It's just that they created organizations that became stupid. And I think this, you know, the stupid organizations obviously has some validity. But you have to ask, you know, how did we get to a situation where the regulators had no control over this? The legislation that we had, you know, obviously facilitated the development of stupidity. And the executive branch was unable to deal with the consequences of this stupidity as it manifests itself. So I think I would encompass the stupid organization's view in a broader framework in which you really say that it was possible and that people could make these mistakes and, of course, get massive amounts of cash compensation for making these mistakes because of the way the system was built. And, you know, was it an accident that derivatives were not properly regulated when there was an opportunity to do that in the 1990s? No, I don't think it was an accident. I think it was a very conscious decision. And so to me, it's all embedded in a political framework and in how these big firms became economically powerful and turned that into political influence, which then allowed further massive acts of stupidity.
Well, Simon Johnson, I want to thank you for coming back to Fresh Air. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Simon Johnson is a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and co-founder of the global economics website Baseline Scenario. His article, The Quiet Coup, is in the May edition of The Atlantic. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Angie's List, providing firsthand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. From DK Eyewitness Travel, publisher of full-color guidebooks that help travelers visualize and plan trips through 3D maps and sample itineraries. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You will be popular.
On the next Fresh Air, Tony Award-winning actress and singer Kristen Chenoweth. She starred as Glinda in the Broadway musical Wicked and co-starred in the TV series Pushing Daisies and The West Wing. She's written her autobiography. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
To be popular, I'll help you be popular. You'll hang with the right clothes.